Well, Malcolm Fraser, let me start by asking something of a personal question. You take a fairly radically new position in this book, where you argue for much greater Australian strategic independence from the United States. Now, you've been a fairly staunch supporter of the US alliance in the past in your time as Prime Minister, but it seems as if this is consistent with many other positions you've taken in recent years, where you leave behind your old party and the liberal conservatism that you were once associated with, if I can put it that way. So I'm wondering, what exactly has changed? Is this book the result of an intellectual journey you've been on, or is it more, as you describe in the book, that the circumstances, Australia's circumstances, have changed?
Well, the world's circumstances around us have changed, and it's not very sensible to say that you're going to stick with old policies when everything else around you is changing quite dramatically. So it's those strange world circumstances that have really led to my change in attitude in relation to the United States. I beg to differ a little bit about, if you look at the asylum seeker policies in relation to apartheid, the rule of law, freedom of information, and a whole host of other things, I have not changed in relation to those. I mean, some of my party weren't happy with opposition to apartheid, but they wore it at the time. And so, in those things, I believe there's been more consistency than might be generally realised.
Now, you say in this book that Australia's always been strategically dependent on a great power, and that you think Australia now needs to make a choice for greater independence.
Yes.
Why now?
Why now? Because there's no global threat as there was when Soviet communism was alive and well. It was an outward-looking, thrusting, aggressive force. And, there were communist insurgencies in our own part of the world. Malayan independence was delayed 10 years while we, the British New Zealanders, helped Malayans overcome that. There was a PKIQ in Indonesia. There was a communist insurrection in the Philippines and also, to some extent, in Thailand. So it wasn't just events in Europe. It wasn't just Soviet tanks marching into Hungary and marching into Czechoslovakia. Rightly or wrongly, it was regarded as global in aspiration. That's certainly the way Soviet leaders spoke. And it was accepted as such till the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1990-91. So the communist threat, the global communist threat, was really off the table. Now, other things also changed. America's ideas of American exceptionalism, it was Morton Abramowitz, one of the founders of the International Crisis Group that Gareth Evans chaired and directed for so long, wrote in Project Syndicate that American exceptionalism dooms American foreign policy. That's not Fraser saying it, it's a native American saying it.
But American exceptionalism is not new, is it?
It's not new, but America unrestrained is new. America has only been a supreme, standalone superpower since the breakup of the Soviet Union. Before then, each superpower was restrained by the other. Neither wanted the nuclear war, so while there were problems, while there were serious alarms, both sides wanted to make sure that peace was not broken. But America, standing alone, the neoconservatives have taken the view that America will really only be secure when the whole world's a democracy. Mm. And it's America's duty to encourage that, if possible, by persuasion, but they don't fall short and say they accept also, it might have to involve force, the use of arms.
And yet you argue in the book that the project to bring that kind of vision about has been a disaster. You say the US shoulders much, not all, of the blame for how the international order the world hoped for in 1990 has been derailed.
A great deal of the blame, yes. The second Gulf War, the second war in Iraq, was an absolute disaster. It was undertaken on the basis of a lie, and known to be a lie. Senator Carl Levin has issued a report in relation to some of these matters, and it was quite clear from the very beginning, the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld administration was looking for an excuse to go to war with Iraq. The first President Bush's senior advisors and Secretary of State Baker, Brent Scowcroft, Larry Eagleburger, and one or two others quite publicly said, don't do it, don't do it. And their loyalty to the President Bush I knew so well was so great that they would not have said that if they hadn't had clearance from the first President Bush. And we forget that the first war involved a coalition of over 30 nations from every corner of the world. The second Gulf War involved Tony Blair, who I think is some kind of a missionary, and missionaries in this regard are dangerous, America, and unfortunately Australia. And it really is an unmitigated disaster. And it was, many people knew it was going to be a disaster because they had no idea how to establish a reasonable democratic government that could contain the rivalries between Kurds, Sunnis and Shias.
I want to press you on this question of Australian independence. I think you offer in the book three options for Australia in the future. One is to, if you like, go all in with the American alliance, as you argue we've been doing. The second option is to maintain the alliance, but with a little bit more distance and independence. And you say effectively that that option is closed off to us because of the troops in Darwin and because of the joint facilities. And then you offer a third option of independence. But can you give us a sense of what actually that means, what it amounts to?
Yes, I can. But let me say why a little bit more why the second option is not really available to us. With a powerful, hard-hitting, offensive task force stationed in Darwin, and however much the Americans or others say, look, this is just for training and whatever, we know it's not. There's a powerful air wing, there are naval ships attached to it, not stationed in Darwin, but available and ready. And in other places, Americans say that this task force can demonstrate exercise power throughout the whole region. And then it's the changed use of Pine Gap. The Pine Gap were, as it was, an information collecting agency. That would be one thing, and I'd still continue to have no problem in it. The changed weapons technologies in particular, and the greater capacity to collect different forms of intelligence through Pine Gap and other somewhat similar facilities, have turned it into a weapons arming and aiming operation. The Pine Gap that killed Australians in the Yemen, the drones that killed Australians in the Yemen, were probably targeted out of Pine Gap. How do we feel about that? We're not meant to be at war with Yemen. There's a great contradiction in President Obama's policies because he stopped the rendition program. He thought it was barbarous and getting America a bad name. But then he goes, instead of just capturing people and questioning them, probably under torture in some remote place, they now use drones and kill them and kill civilians in addition. Now, drones are not all that expensive. given 20, 25 years, and this, they're outlawed by international agreement. Many, many countries will have the same capacity that the Americans have now, and the world would be total chaos. You translate these changes into our part of the world. When it was the Middle East, or rather fairly remote from Australia, and not so important, really, to our own future. But Hugh White has also written that a conflict between China and Japan is possible. The Americans have made it plain that they side with Japan if there is a conflict. And as things are, we would get dragged into that conflict when we should. Our interest would be to stay well clear of it. Now, if you've got those troops in Darwin being used in relation to such a conflict, and Pine Gap is being used to give direction to a variety of weapon systems, the Prime Minister could get up and say, oh, look, we're not involved, we're not complicit. But we would be complicit. The world would know we were complicit. And that means that the United States has the power to take Australia to war, really, as Britain 100 years ago had the power to take Australia to war, because we were part of the empire and Britain made policy for the empire as a whole. And we did not make separate decisions about peace and war. And that probably included, although there's some debate about the intent of Sir Robert Menzies' words, that probably included that declaration of war in the Second World War, but certainly in the First.
So that then brings us to the
power that should reside in the Australian government, free and unfettered. It should not be a power that we delegate to the United States presidency.
Which brings us to the independence option then. Can you briefly sketch out what that looks like, how it's different to today?
Well, it would certainly involve a greater expenditure on defence. Americans have sometimes accused us of having a free ride on because of the relationship. Well, we do spend very little on defence, and maybe we'd have to nearly double it. I suspect we'd certainly have to go to 2.5-3% of GNP. But many European states that are no wealthier and maybe not as wealthy as Australia can afford to put out that, you know, spend much more than we do. So we'd have to do that. I would also like to see Australia take another decision. Just as Australians, after the Second World War, came to the view, and it was a unified bipartisan view, that with 7 million people, Australia was not defensible. We had to build up our resources, our capacities. And we began, therefore, as the centerpiece of that, a major migration program from many countries around the world. I believe we should say we want 40, 45 million people in Australia. Now, I know that also would involve investment in infrastructure, in water, in the environment, but it would be a lesser burden on today's Australians than the burden accepted by the 7 million Australians after the Second World War. So the idea of greater independence, strategic independence, will certainly have costs, but it will enable Australia to point to the future, to an objective, to a purpose, what we want to do with this country. And then, as the country seemed to be independent and not parroting arguments used by the United States, which is the current situation, if there were a flare-up, a problem in the Northwest Pacific involving China, Japan and America, working with other countries such as ASEAN, we would have a much better chance of trying to moderate tensions, trying to get people to see the great damage done to everyone as a result. result of a major conflict.
But just to clarify, Malcolm Fraser, you're not calling for armed neutrality, are you, like Sweden or Switzerland, say?
No, I'm not. Well, yes, but the Swiss are armed to the teeth.
Hmm.
Every Swiss man up to the age of, what, 50, 55, takes his military weapons home with him.
So
don't say that the Swiss is unarmed neutrality.
No, no, sorry, I said armed neutrality. Is that what you're calling for?
No, I'm arguing for the capacity to make a judgment based on Australia's long-term interest about what we do and about strategic policy. Now, I would argue very strongly that we should be working very closely with other countries of our own region. I don't think we really are a Western country, but Australia and Western countries have underrated, I believe, the achievement of ASEAN, where countries that were former enemies, certainly in different stages of development, have come together in an association and are working to maintain balance, to advance their own progress, but also to contribute to peace throughout the region. Now, we could work much more effectively with that grouping of nations if we were known to be independent and not a surrogate or a deputy sheriff of the United States. So I'm not saying that we should just say, you know, shut our eyes to the problems that clearly exist. We should seize opportunities with our neighbours, and also in the United Nations, in which I happen to believe, to make that organisation more effective.
No, it's perfectly clear, to me at least, that your proposal is not Pollyanna-ish. If you're arguing for a great expansion of defence spending, for instance, then you can't be accused of that. But I do want to clarify exactly what you have in mind, if not armed neutrality. Are you saying, for instance, that we ought to essentially abrogate ANZUS? Or what sort of model? Is there a contemporary model? Are you looking at Canada or France, for instance, for an example?
No two situations are exactly similar. Canada did not go to war with America in Vietnam or in Iraq. And all right, you can argue that it might have been more difficult for Canada to keep out of that. Or you could argue, if you like, that because of its geography, Canada has a luxury that would be more difficult for Australia to enjoy. But Canada has exercised much greater independence over the years than we have. Pierre Trudeau used to communicate, and I think even visited Castro, Cuba. Certainly something which the Americans would not have enjoyed very much.
Mm.
And that did not seem to harm their relationship. So I'm not saying that we would not have good relations with America. They, of course, might, it's theoretically possible that they'd become vindictive, trying to persuade their corporations to disinvest from Australia. But I don't believe that would happen. New Zealand, when they banned nuclear-powered and armed ships from their harbours, paid a price for a while, but they've emerged in a better position. And because of the Cold War, I was opposed to it at the time. But I think New Zealand was right now. And I don't think there is a particular model. We would be a country that would make its own decisions. If America was prepared to wear ANZUS, as ANZUS was written and drawn in 1951, which was a consultation if there were an attack on the armed forces or the territory of either country, well, it was three then because New Zealand was in the Pacific Theater. If that's what ANZUS said and if that's what ANZUS meant, I'd be very happy to keep it. But America has persuaded us over the years to interpret ANZUS as meaning so much more than that.
Mm.
In Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan have nothing whatever to do with ANZUS. And you know, one of the things that, and this is not really a criticism of Americans because it's a characteristic of great powers, a lesser power, a smaller country like Australia, you don't buy brownie points with superpowers or major powers. And that applied in the old days to Britain, and it applies now to the United States. Great powers do what is in their interests. And if they think your interest or well-being is part of their interest, well, so be it.
I've got one more question for you. You make the argument that one of the reasons a greater level of strategic independence is possible for Australia is that the China threat has been overstated.
Yes, I believe that greatly.
I've got a counter argument that I want to put to you. It's not necessarily that China is somehow malevolent or expansionist. It is simply that China, because of its growing power, will naturally give itself or grant itself a larger stake in the international system and will, if you like, throw its weight around a little more. So, for instance, that China, simply because it has become a world power, will want a sphere of influence in Asia and perhaps even a Chinese version of the Monroe Doctrine. What's your response to that?
I think a Chinese version of the Monroe Doctrine is going too far. China has never, to this point, been an imperial power the way European states, Japan and America have been imperial powers. Certainly her economic strength gains influence, and that will continue. Nothing can stop that except internal disruption, which some people argue will happen, and I don't believe it will. I think the Chinese have shown a remarkable capacity to improve the living standards of many, many people in China and also maintain a degree of stability. Their government will evolve, but I don't believe it will ever become an American or a Western-style democracy. They will find other solutions to problems as they arise in the future. A lot of the claims about China, America says she's worried about trade routes. Well, open trade routes are in the interests of every country in the region. And the American doesn't need a policy of containment to protect the trade routes, because China and all other countries want access to the American market. They also want American investment. They want American money and resources. It's in the interests of China and of America, or of China and of Australia, and China and all the other countries with whom she trades, to maintain open and free trade. Mm. So, you know, to build up an argument for America's policy of containment, that's one half of American policy to China. I mean, I know they conduct a strategic and economic dialogue, but when I speak to Chinese, they say, which America are we to believe? The one that talks consultation and whatever, or the military build-up? There's a judgment based in that. You've got to make a judgment based on your own best interest, your own best analysis. And if you look at what's happened in the Middle East, you can't point to a single American success. I don't want them to make as big a mess of the Western Pacific as they've made of the Middle East.
Mr. Fraser, thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.